were over 100 soldiers, and so they were leaders. And I think there's three good lessons that we can learn. That's not only good for soldiers, but also great for soldiers of Christ. Nate is both. He's our brother. He's also a soldier in the service. And I'm, you know, the soldiers have always been special in our family. Maybe it's the way I grew up, but I mean, it was a big, important thing to serve your country. And I wish we had more of that in our country. I think we'll get back to it again, but in particular, I want to meditate on these lessons of the centurions. And I have three passages of Scripture, and each of them I'm going to have the elders read these passages as I need them. And they don't have to even come forward. They could just read it from the back out loud. We don't really have anybody watching tonight, so it'll pick it up. But let's read about centurion number one. That's in Matthew 8, 5 through 13. Would you read that, Darren?
This is Matthew 8, 5 through 13. And when he had entered Capernaum, a centurion came to him, entreating him, and saying, "Lord, my servant is lying paralyzed at home, suffering great pain." And he said to him, "I will come and heal him." But the centurion answered and said, "Lord, I am not worthy for you to come under my roof. Just say the word, and my servant will be healed. For I too am a man under authority, with soldiers under me, and I say to this one, 'Go,' and he goes, and to another, 'Come,' and he comes, and to my slave, 'Do this,' and he does it." Now when Jesus heard this, he marveled, and said to those who were following, "Truly, I say to you, I have not found such great faith with anyone in Israel. And I say to you that many shall come from east and west and recline at the table with Abraham and Isaac and Jacob in the kingdom of heaven. But the sons of the kingdom shall be cast out into outer darkness. In that place there shall be weeping and gnashing of teeth." And Jesus said to the centurion, "Go your way, let it be done to you as you have believed." And the servant was healed that very hour.
This Roman centurion, he was the head officer over 100 soldiers, and they just didn't hand those positions out. If you were going to have someone leading 100 soldiers, and those Roman soldiers had a lot of training, you need to have someone who was a good leader. And the abbreviated account of Matthew alludes that the centurion personally came to Jesus. But Luke gives us a little bit more information. In Luke chapter 7, verse 3 through 5, it stated that actually, quote, "He sent some Jewish elders asking him to come and save the life of his slave." This slave servant that he had, he had compassion for him, and he was very deathly ill. And now why would he send the Jewish elders at a minimum earlier to Jesus? It seems in 8 verse 4 and 5, when they had come to Jesus, or 7 verse 4 and 5, actually 8 verse 4 and 5, when they had come to Jesus, they earnestly entreated him, saying, "He is worthy for you to grant this to him, for he loves our nation, and he was the one who built us a synagogue." He was a man who admired the Jewish faith, though he was a Roman soldier. And we often use this account to demonstrate, oh, look what Jesus' power could do. He has remote control power. He's not even there, and he's healing people a great distance away. And that's quite impressive. I'm sure if Apple had that technology, they would try to market it or something. He had miraculous powers, amazing powers, but that's not what I want you to take from this. I want you to see that here's a Roman soldier that's held out as an example of great faith. And what was so great about it was, you know, here's a man who says, I have authority over me, but the one he focuses on, that I have authority over men, I tell him to come, tell him to go, do this. They do what I ask them to. But he recognizes there is someone higher than him. And I think it goes beyond, you know, Caesar. I think he sees in Jesus something that we all need to see in Jesus, something we always have to have in our faith. You see, there's all kinds of different faith that we could have. When he says, Lord, do not trouble yourself further, for I'm not worthy for you to come under my roof. Jesus said, I'll come. I'll lay my hands on him. I'll fix him. But he said, just speak the word. Just speak the word. There's two things in there. One, faith, but two, humility. He had a humble faith. We have to be careful what kind of faith that we have. We have to have a faith in Jesus that constantly recognizes we're not worthy to even be in the same room as Jesus. And yet, he came down to earth and took the form of a man so that he could experience all that we have in life, so he could be tempted in every way as we are, yet without sin. That humbles me. When the God of the universe, Emmanuel, God with us, would do such a thing for us. I think that we're never better than when we have a humble faith. And so charge number one, always be humble in our faith, no matter where we are in this world, whether we're in Camp Hill and we're walking with a cane, or we're in Afghanistan and maybe carrying a weapon. I think, you know, I don't know what NATO will be doing, maybe building runways, but there'll be very impressive planes, a lot of things going on. But, you know, we have to always keep faith and humility together, because if we don't, one will banish the other. God's power. It's not our power. He's the one that makes things happen in our life. He's the one who undergirds us with his strength. He's the one to whom we always must be humble. We worship the King of the universe, which makes me not the King of the universe. But then I trust him more. And so lesson number one, charge number one, make it military. Always be humble in our faith. Always be humble in our faith. God is on the throne. Jesus Christ is in control. Here, Afghanistan, Pakistan, any stand, doesn't matter. He's still the king, which makes us his slave. Centurion number two, turn to Mark chapter 15, verses 33 through 39. Mark 13, 33 through 39. Go ahead and read that, Larry.
When the sixth hour came, darkness fell over the whole land until the ninth hour. At the ninth hour, Jesus cried out with a loud voice, Eloi, Eloi, lama sabachthani, which is translated, my God, why have you forsaken me? When some of the bystanders heard it, they began saying, behold, he is calling for Elijah. Someone ran and filled a sponge with sour wine, put it on a reed and gave him a drink, saying, let us see whether Elijah will come down to take him down. Then Jesus uttered a loud cry and breathed his last, and the veil of the temple was torn in two from top to bottom. When the centurion, who was standing right in front of him, saw the way he breathed his last, he said, truly this man was the Son of God.
You know, it was the day of crucifixion for Jesus, and the time was about 3 o'clock in the afternoon. There was nobody on earth who could really comprehend the last 18 hours of Jesus' life. I mean, it was a jam-packed day. A lot of times if I get really busy, you know when you get so busy, you don't eat, and then your stomach's telling you like 4 or 5 times, well, you better eat, and then you start getting like the shakes. Well, Jesus had one of those days times a million by far. Look at all he covered in his last 18 hours. He shared in the Last Supper with the man that he spent the last 3 years with in the ministry. I mean, he had that last meal. I mean, Nate's going off to Afghanistan, and we're pretty hopeful he'll be back. And, you know, I'm pretty hopeful I'll see you all next week. You know, anything could happen, but the odds are we live our life like we're going to see each other again. Jesus had this meal with these men whom he is close with, and he knows this is the last time before he undergoes crucifixion that he's going to spend with them. They're going to go through a horrible time. If you can imagine, you know, what they're going to see. Jesus wept at the death of Lazarus, and yet these men were falling apart. It's no wonder that they abandoned him. They were really under turmoil during this meal. He prayed the most fervent prayer in history of mankind. and the Garden of Gethsemane. I challenge you to compare any prayer you've ever had, any pressure you've ever had, to where you're praying so hard, sweat is falling off like drops of blood. I mean, the apostles, they were there. They even fell asleep. And he prayed in segments of like, all this I do for you, and you can't tarry with me for an hour. It was quite a prayer that he had. He was arrested as his close friends all abandoned him. They betray and forsake him. He was falsely charged in a series of trials that led to his flogging and his humiliation. But it got worse. Through the process of a truth scourge and then preparation of a death scourge, he was sentenced to death on the cross. Not only that, he'd be forced to carry that cross. It was very heavy. It would be strapped to him. He could fall two or three times face first. Nothing would prepare. They'd often strap just the cross beam on you, tie your arms to it, and you'd be carrying it. And if you fell forward with 80 pounds of wood on your shoulder, that's going to hurt. It's going to hurt quite a bit when you hit the pavement. Then he, after being forced to carry this cross, he would, he had very little strength left. Another man had to carry it for him. He was stripped naked and nailed to this cross through his hands and his feet just to add more excruciating pain. And as he's hanging up there naked, a lot of things are going on. They cast lots for his clothing, for one particular piece that they did not want to tear apart. He looks around, he says, "Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do." He had composure on that cross. I don't know about you, but the first time they laid one stripe on me in a truth scourge, okay, I mean, I'd really be considering what I was doing. And if you don't think so, you know, let's go, I'll go get a pool cue, and you go ahead, take your shirt off, and we'll give you a couple smacks with that pool cue in the back. And you might be rethinking a strategy at that point. Jesus was completely in composure. When he finally took his last breath, he gave up his spirit. The earth trembled, and the veil in the temple was torn from top to bottom. He quotes Psalm 22:1, my God, why hast thou forsaken me? Oftentimes, Jews would, and we do it in our culture too, we might quote the first part of something and then have somebody finish it. If you went to finish Psalm 22, it would break your heart. My God, why hast thou forsaken me? Remember, there's a centurion. He's watching this. He's over 100 soldiers. It's a busy place on Calvary. And he's watching all this unfold. He says, I cried day and night, but you do not answer. Psalm 22:2. And by night I have no rest. It really describes what he's going through. Yet you are holy. Oh, you who are enthroned upon the praises of Israel. In you the fathers trusted. They trusted and you delivered them. To you they cried out and were delivered. In you they trusted and were not disappointed. See, God's always bailing Israel out. Go back and read the Old Testament. You'll see. But Jesus, wasn't that way for him. Psalm 22, verse 6. But I am a worm. That's a pretty low thing. I used tapeworm this morning. I mean, worm is just somebody who would be low. A reproach of man and despised by the people. All who see me sneer at me. They separate with their lip. They wag the head saying, commit yourself to the Lord. Let him deliver him. Let him rescue him because he delights in him. The thieves, one of the thieves mocked him. Other people mocked him. Oh, call for Elijah. Come on, let God come deliver you. Yet you are he who brought me forth from the womb. You made me trust upon my mother's breast. Upon you I was cast from birth. You have been my God from my mother's womb. Be not far from me, for trouble is near, for there is none to help. Have I ever mentioned the cross is the loneliest place on earth? No place more desolate than Jesus' cross. Many bulls have surrounded me. The strong bulls of Bashan have encircled me. They're the enemy. They're all around Jesus. They opened wide their mouth at me as a ravening and roaring lion. I'm poured out like water. All my bones are out of joint. My heart is like wax. It is melted within me. Jesus' shoulders probably would have been out of the socket, hanging there. You can't hang your body without your shoulders coming out of the socket. And look what they have. My strength is dried up like a potsherd. My tongue cleaves to my jaws, and you lay me down in the dust of death. For dogs have surrounded me, a band of evildoers have encompassed me. They pierced my hands and feet. I remember one time I built a treehouse as a kid. And kids, they don't do things like they would in fancy land. I just hammered a big spike through a branch and it came out the other side. I'll leave it. It's okay. Worked great till I pulled up the rope and the nail stuck right through my hand. Now, I didn't believe in, you know, God. I was a kid, but I screamed. I flew down a tree. I ran in. I thought I was going to die. I thought if you cut your wrist, you're going to die. Now, imagine if you got both hands nailed and then your feet. Can you imagine the anxiety you would have? This centurion, he's witnessing this whole crucifixion. He's not a Christian. He's not a Jew. He makes his living killing Jews, hanging them on a cross, overseeing it. He's a foreman for the project. I can count all my bones. They look at me and stare at me. They divide my garments. For my clothing, they cast lots. You can read the rest of that, but it's a very graphic description in prophecy of what happened to Jesus. This centurion sees everything unfold. And what's interesting is the death of Jesus was totally different than all these other people this centurion had overseen their death. There were a lot of strange things going on that day. First of all, nobody would hang 6 hours on a cross. You might hang days. But there were some things that happened. You know, he saw certain events unfold. It was his job to oversee it. I mean, do you think he might have noticed the sky went dark 3 hours ago? To the point where historians argued, why did it go dark? Was it eclipse? Was it some kind of miracle? What was it? That's recorded in historical documents outside of the Bible. He sees how Jesus died. This man made a living as a professional executor. He likely oversaw the death by crucifixion of hundreds, even thousands of people in his time. He wouldn't have been made a leader had he not had experience in it. And yet, while he was looking at this, look what happened. The death of Jesus, the minute he dies, this man has been bringing everything in. And the cherry on the cake was, Jesus said in John 19, I believe 36, into thy hands I commit my spirit. That was what he said last. And he died like that. That was a cherry on the cake. All these other things he saw, here he sees Jesus speak his death. I'm going to die. He was looking up. He didn't die of asphyxiation. He just died immediately like that. And this centurion, who saw all these other things and sees Jesus die, he utters what I think is one of the most beautiful sentences in all the Bible. Truly, this man was the Son of God. Truly, this man was the Son of God. Most important thing I think ever rolled off that man's lips. He could see the evidence before him and he reasoned for himself. I mean, he was taking all this in. That's what Jesus requires us to do. That's why we got four accounts of his life story. We read it and we start bringing it in. We come to the conclusion, truly, he's the Son of God. Charge number two that I would give to Nate and all soldiers of Christ, do not be distracted from the truth. Never be distracted from the truth. There are many things occurring around us in this world. The shift of moral standing is horrible in our culture. There have been more catastrophes with the weather and drought and disasters. I don't remember a time where we were in a position, at least not in my lifetime, where the risk of annihilation of mankind is so high. I mean, at least with the Soviet Empire, you knew there was one country over there. Every country is trying to acquire nuclear weapons. I mean, it's quite a bit of chaos. Sometimes I have to just turn off the news. I mean, it's that scary. You have issues at schools. You know, you have your bills. You have all these different things. And if we're not careful, we're going to see each individual event like the centurion did not see it. He was adding them up. I see sky growing dark. Boy, it was a bogus charge. Okay, he's king of the Jews. Now these other Jews are saying, not king of the Jews. He saw how, he heard about these miracles. You couldn't live in Jerusalem and not hear that Jesus was around. He put it all together and saw how he did as an expert in people who put people to death, said, truly, this is the Son of God. We have to be able to pull all these events going on around us, whether they be in Afghanistan, whether they be in Camp Hill, whether they be anywhere in between. We add all those events up, and we better come out with this saying in the end. Truly, he is still the Son of God. Because if we fail to do that, then we ultimately fail in everything that we do. I don't know. I mean, Nate and I have talked before. If you've ever heard anything about the military, typically it's a little bit different than church. They use different language, don't they, Nate? It's a totally different environment. And Abby went to the ROTC camp this summer, and you know, they didn't talk like Mr. Rogers, did they? No, it was like a mini boot camp. Well, from very beginning at basic training, they're not yelling expressions of love for you. They don't. Unless if you love to do push-ups and you love to have the breath of a drill sergeant in your face. You know, Afghanistan is there's a lot of things you see in war. And I would always say to anybody, whether it be Nate or anybody who ever has to go to war, that whatever you see, you better interpret it and come up that Jesus is truly the Son of God, because you're going to need it to get through anything. We're in a war here. He's going over to a war there. It's the same structure, the same end. And then centurion number 3. Tim will read Acts 10. Turn to Acts 10. He'll read verses 10, 1 through 4, and then 44 through 48.
Now there was a man at Caesarea named Cornelius, a centurion of what was called the Italian cohort, a devout man and one who feared God with all his household, and gave many alms to the Jewish people and prayed to God continually. About the ninth hour of the day, he clearly saw in a vision an angel of God who had just come in and said to him, Cornelius. And fixing his gaze on him and being much alarmed, he said, What is it, Lord? And he said to him, Your prayers and alms have ascended as a memorial before God. 44. While Peter was still speaking these words, the Holy Spirit fell upon all those who were listening to the message. All the circumcised believers who came with Peter were amazed, because the gift of the Holy Spirit had been poured out on the Gentiles also. For they were hearing them speaking with tongues and exalting God. Then Peter answered, Surely no one can refuse the water for these to be baptized, who have received the Holy Spirit just as we did, can he? And he ordered them to be baptized in the name of Jesus Christ. Then they asked him to stay on for a few days.
I asked the three elders that we had present today to read these scriptures because they're my leaders. And a lot of times I'll run into people, you know, over at Golden Living, and they think like I'm the leader of the church. I'm a leader, but they're my leaders. And the elders wanted to do something special for tonight because we love him and appreciate him. And I wanted them to be involved as well. Even though Cornelius was not a Jew, he is very religious. He was a devout man. He feared God. He prayed always. He gave much alms to the poor. I mean, honestly, you would love to have Cornelius in your church. You would say, oh, he must be a brother. But according, if you combine Acts 11 with it and you piece everything together, the story goes like this. Cornelius knew he was incomplete. He was praying as a Roman centurion. He's a soldier. He's only admired the Jews from a distance. He wants in on this God that they worship. And he's trying ever so hard in his prayers and in how he lives. He's crying out to God, God, I want to be part of this. It's not by accident that he's the first Gentile added to the church. So God sends an angel. The angel tells him to send for Peter in Joppa, early form of email from the first century. And he sends for Peter, and a couple days later, Peter is down. And Peter had his, as we covered in Acts 10 before, he had to have his conversion that the Gentiles are now acceptable through the lowering of the veil. Those two things come together. Peter is explaining to him the message of the gospel. And God indicates that he's accepting the Gentiles by causing a miracle to occur. They begin speaking in tongues and exalting God in tongues they've never rehearsed. And Peter comes to the conclusion, who here can forbid water? And then he baptizes them. Now, what I want you to take from this is that charge number three, we always do the best we can with what we have. Always do the best we can with what we have. It protects us in a few ways. First of all, too many times we maybe heap expectations on people when we don't know exactly everything they're dealing with. We might judge somebody and not be aware of any history of a situation. And that's where a lot of troubles come from. But the bigger focus is that there's only a very little in this world that we ever have control over. You ever think about that? I know that this is kind of funny. Maybe it's a guy thing, but I hate sitting down in the living room and have my wife hold the remote control. Is it a guy thing? It's like it emasculates me when my wife flips through the TV sets. I don't know what it is. I mean, it's just like, I don't want to watch this. I want to watch this. And she'll come in with a bowl of ice cream or something, and she'll grab the remote. And I might be watching something, or I know something's coming up, but I don't know why it is. I don't even have control over my remote control in the house. I have partial control over the remote control. So we have that power. For a few years, we seem to have some control over our kids until they walk. I tell you, when I realized the first time that, you know, you better have good control of your children and teach them to have self-control before you lose control, or you're going to really lose control later. You only have them for a short time, but yeah, you're only boss of your family, I guess, for a short time. If the economy's going well, we might have a little control over our budget. But as soon as something happens, then that little nest egg you have starts vanishing. I thought I had control over this. I had everything written down in a plan. Well, the world had something they wanted to update you on. We can choose our friends. At least we have control over that. Maybe one might turn on you and then you lose control there. We don't really have that much control over anything. We don't. And therefore, we can only do the best we have with what we have. The one thing we always have control over is, you know, what do we do with the circumstances as they come? That's the only real thing that I can think of we have control over. You know, you look at Joe. You know, for a long time, Joe over at Hershey, he didn't have any control over his hands and stuff. And he's thrilled that he has control over his hands. But, you know, look at all the things that come up into our life and say, you don't have control over this. We have to learn that there's a default button. See, if your computer really is running bad, somebody ever called, my computer's running real slow. Doug, can you help me? Don calls once every 3 months. First thing I do is I say, shut your computer off, turn it on. I want whatever's in the random access memory to forget. I want to have forced Alzheimer's on that computer first and see what I'm going to deal with. We have to have a reset button, a default button. And I think that this is one of the things that we can learn from Cornelius. He was doing the best he could with what he had. He didn't have a covenant with God. But let me tell you, he lived probably better life than most of us do. He was living the faith he wished he could have. But God, he always ends up making up in the end. See, there's going to be things that happen in our life where at the end of the day, if we just say, you know what, I did the best I could with what I had. Sometimes I fail. And somebody might come to me and say, Doug, you let me down. I'll say, listen, brother, I did the best I could with what I had. If they still don't understand, I'll say, okay, ask me a question. Do you understand? Okay. Ask me if I did the best I could with what I had. Okay, Doug, did you do the best you could with what you had? Yes. What else can I do? That's how you control things that are out of your control. And that's how you turn the steering wheel over to God. We say to God, by the way, I love my wife so much, but I can't have her drive when I'm in the car either. There's something, I can't sleep. I can't do that. I'm telling you, I don't have to drink coffee. All I have to do is bring Jana, and the thought of me getting tired and having her drive, you know, she's a fine driver. She is. But there's something I can't do it. It's hard for me to turn the wheel over. I mean, that one time I was hit with a meteor in the head and I couldn't drive, but other than that, and she knows that. But the same way she's willing to turn you're going to drive, she just expects me to drive. We need to expect God's going to drive. You know, if the roads are real slippery, turn the wheel over to God. And how we do that is we do the best we can with what we have, and we turn it over just like Cornelius did. And in the end, that's going to be the best coping mechanism we have. In war, you know, soldiers, they draw up everything, and they have their little compasses, and they're standing around, a guy with a pipe smoking, and he's trying to direct everything. Let me tell you, war is something few people have much control over. You just don't have much control. We're in a spiritual war here. And sometimes we may even lose a battle. But we have to say, I got to go back to default. Shut the computer off. Have it boot up. Be greeted with the message. Do the best you can with what you have. And then let God take over. If we do that, we're going to make it. Every single time. So three centurions. I chose three officers who were not, in the beginning, Christian. Three officers, and I use them to have three examples. Always be humble in our faith. Number two, do not be distracted from the truth. And number three, always do the best you can with what you have. Now, Nate, on Wednesday, I believe, if you can be here Wednesday, many people have written you cards, big stack of cards. Take them with you to Afghanistan. And pull those cards out as you go along. I mean, they just gave me a card shower. It's really cool. We have a box and we kept the cards in it. And if one of you ever nasty to them, I'm going to go back and read the card and I'm going to show you. Wait, you sat out. No. No, but it really was nice to read all those cards. When you get down, open one of those cards up. Or if you want to read them all, tuck them away. Whatever you have to do, because we love you very much. Your mom loves you very much. We all care for you. And we want you to know, regardless of where you are, we're going to be praying for you, and we're going to be so happy when you're back. Okay, brother? Okay. If you'd like to respond to the invitation, why don't you come forward while we stand and sing?